Hey, listeners, we want to know what you think of the show. Leave us feedback on our new voicemail line, 702-706-TALK. That's 702-706-TALK. Or email us at podcast@storycorps.org. We also want to hear your stories, so listen for a special prompt at the end of each episode.
Hi, I'm Dave Isay, founder of StoryCorps. This message comes from NPR sponsor Subaru and the 2024 Subaru Crosstrek Wilderness. Explore new territory with 9.3 inches of ground clearance, a stunning 11.6 inch touchscreen, and EyeSight driver assist technology. Adventure on the edge.
Jasmine, have I ever told you much about my dad?
Not really.
Okay, so he was kind of a character. His name was Anthony, but everybody called him Sonny. He was one of those people who didn't really believe that rules were made for him. One time we were on vacation and we were driving through New York City. We started to go over the George Washington Bridge and he realized we missed our exit. Now, Jasmine, if you were driving that car, what would you do?
I'd turn around.
And how would you do that?
Drive to the next exit, I guess.
Right? I think any reasonable person would do what you just described, but not my dad. My dad stopped the car, put it in reverse, and backed up halfway across the George Washington Bridge to get back to our exit.
Never mind the hundreds of cars around you.
I mean, this is how I grew up. This was totally normal for me as a kid. He was also the kind of guy who had all these little sayings, like catchphrases, and his favorite was, there are three ways to do things. The right way, the wrong way, and my way. Growing up, I used to think he invented this saying, but of course, now I know he didn't.
I will. Listen to me very carefully. There are three ways of doing things around here. The right way, the wrong way, and the way that I do it.
Kids, there's three ways to do things. The right way, the wrong way, and the max power way.
Isn't that the wrong way?
Yeah, but faster.
So I tell you all this because this new season of the StoryCorps podcast, the one that we're kicking off with this episode, is called My Way. Stories from people who found a rhythm all their own and confidently marched to it their whole lives. Consequences and other people's opinions be damned.
Call it audacity, courage, or chutzpah. Everyone in the next few episodes had something inside that helped them make decisions that are not what other people expected. They ended up being the right ones for them. I'm Jasmine Morris.
And I'm Michael Garofalo. Welcome to a brand new season of the StoryCorps podcast from NPR.
Okay, so our first two stories are about work, and both are about people who found a way to make it in a world that wasn't exactly built for them.
My father had a heart attack, and I was 13 years old, and my mother said, you can't go back to school, you're going to have to find a job.
That's Clayton Sherrod, and he's talking about growing up in Birmingham, Alabama, in the late 1950s.
So I went to the country club right outside of Birmingham to make some money. During that time, it was extremely segregated. The only way a person who's Black or African-American could really go to a country club is to go there to work. And I always wanted to go up to the kitchen and wash dishes because it was really fascinating to see those guys cooking. So I made up my mind that I was going to be a chef. All my friends told me I was crazy, but I saw something that no one else could see, and that is me walking around with that big tall hat on. So I counted how many positions it was from washing dishes to the executive chef. And we had like a three-room house. So what I did, I had my chart pinned to the wall in our little outdoor bathroom there. And I would mark every time I got a promotion. And then I would turn the light off and I would dance. And I would sing Johnny B. Goode, and I changed it to Clayton B. Goode. You're so good. And you know, I didn't mind all the hard work. Actually, I loved it. I worked the whole weekend without going home. And I worked myself up to sous chef. And that was this guy named Frank Cahy, who was executive chef. He told me one day, he said, I know what you're trying to do. You think you're going to be the chef here. He said, but I'm going to be here for life. He said, you might as well just either keep working under me or go somewhere else. So what I did, I was sneaky. You know, in the back of trade magazines, there's articles in there looking for chefs all over the country. I wrote one of the best looking resumes and signed Frank Cahy's name on it. And sent it to all of these headhunters all over the country. And he actually thought he was famous. He said, everybody knew about him, but he didn't know that was me that did it. And the general manager got tired of it. He said, Frank, every time you come to me for raises and people want you here, people want you there. He said, right now, at this very moment, I consider you dead. Frank, he turned white as a sheet. And he said, well, what are you going to do? The general manager said, well, Clayton, can you take care of it until we find another chef? I said, I'd be more than happy to. That's all I needed. I never even looked back.
Chef Clayton Sherrod. He was only 19 when he took over the kitchen at that country club.
Now, to become executive chef as a young black man in Alabama in 1964, Clayton had to get creative. And agree with his methods or not, you gotta admit, he did find a way.
Yeah, and our next story also involves a creative and brave workaround from someone who didn't think the way the world wanted her to.
In school, they just called me stupid, dumb, lazy. I really thought that that's what was wrong with me. And when there was something that I needed to do, it was like a door in my brain would drop, and it wouldn't allow me to process any of the information. I didn't realize that I actually had a learning disability.
That's Eileen Kushner. She grew up in Detroit in the 1950s, and she always had trouble with simple math and reading. When she got out of high school, she married her husband Larry almost right away, and they started a family. Eileen hoped that as a stay-at-home mom, she could hide her learning problems. But it didn't work out that way.
Raising the kids, we had no extra spending money.
Sometimes for food, it got pretty tough. And I said, how about going to talk to Carl at the McDonald's? Maybe he could hire you.
And I said, Carl, I'd like to make French fries and make your shakes for you. I'll be the best employee. And he said, you're hired. I remember coming home and I was so excited, dancing around. I got a job.
In those days, there were no computers. If a customer wanted a hamburger, fry, and a Coke, you manually had to add it up.
Exactly. I had done such a good job, and I was starting to feel really good about myself until one day, Carl leaded me over to the counter and said, Eileen, this is your next responsibility. And in my mind, I knew that I wasn't able to add. I thought I was going to die. I went home that night crying my eyes out to you and saying, I'm going to quit, Larry, because I don't want them to know that I don't know how to count the money back. And you said to me, Eileen, you're going to be okay. You came home and you brought singles, $5 bills, and coins. And we started playing McDonald's. Do you remember?
I sure do.
I would stand on one side of the table in the kitchen and you stood on the other. And you would pretend you were a customer. And the following day, I went back and asked if I could please have some Big Mac boxes, some fry boxes, and some cups. And then every day, Larry, with your help, I learned it. Larry, thank you. You opened up my world.
I just opened the door for you. You took the ball and ran with it, though, after that. Do you see yourself differently today than you were 30 years ago?
I learned a very valuable lesson from Edison. After he invented the light bulb, this young gentleman came up to him and asked him, how did it feel to fail over 2,000 times? Edison said, I never failed once. It was a 2,000-step process. And this is what my life has been, Larry. More than 2,000 steps. But we made it.
We did.
We made it.
Over the years, Eileen moved her way up at McDonald's, eventually becoming a manager, and then attending Hamburger University, getting a degree in what McDonald's calls hamburgerology.
At one point, Eileen and Larry owned 5 McDonald's branches together. So, you know, in the end, she really did have it her way.
Michael, that's Burger King.
Oh. Oops. All right, anyway, we've got more stories after the break. Stay with us.
Thank you.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Dignity Memorial. When we think about the people we love, it's not the big things we miss the most, it's the details. What memories will your loved ones cherish when you're gone? With Dignity Memorial, you can pre-plan your celebration of life now to protect your loved ones, because nobody should have to plan for a loss while they're experiencing one. Planning truly is one of the best gifts you can give your family. For additional information, visit dignitymemorial.com.
We've been listening to stories about people who did things their own way.
These next two feature people who put themselves in situations that most other people would run away from.
First, we'll hear from two brothers. Paul Corbett Brown and John Brown sat down together in Charleston, West Virginia. Paul, who's the older brother, wanted to know about something that happened in John's life when he was younger.
When did you first find your voice?
Well, I guess I found my literal voice in 1993. I was driving to work, scanning through the stations, and I landed on Joy and Praise, 101 something.
WJYP, Praise 101.
Good morning. Our time is 10:02.
The announcer was saying all these terrible, untrue things about gay and lesbian people and about how crude they are. And so I pulled off the side of the road and I went to a payphone and I called him and I said, "What are you thinking? If you're going to talk about gay and lesbian people, you should have somebody gay and lesbian on the show to provide a balanced perspective in the very least." "Oh, we've tried many times to get somebody on the show." And I said, "I'll be on your show." And he said, "No, you won't. People say that, but they won't show up." And I said, "You tell me the time and the place, and I'll be there." And he said, "We're going to have a live segment. If you want to be here, we'll put you on the show for 10 minutes. And I said, "Okay." I hung up the phone, and of course, I was shaking like a leaf. And I went to the Hardee's across the street, and I got $5 and quarters, and I called everybody I knew. And I said, "You got to call into this show because I'm absolutely petrified." So at any rate, I went up there, and we were in this little studio, and I remember there was just a bare light bulb hanging down from the ceiling.
We welcome you today to the Thursday Forum. With us in the studio, we have John Brown.
We went through the first 15 minutes, and he said, "I'm sure you won't want to stay." And I said, "No, I'm perfectly comfortable. I'll sit here until you're ready to turn off the microphone." And we sat there for another 2.5 hours and talked about these issues. I was just as comfortable as I could be because what I was there to say, I owned.
"I don't believe I'm an abomination. I don't believe I ever have been or ever will be."
I just felt so empowered, even though 99.9% of the callers who called into that show just talked about me like I was a dog.
"The majority that are in the homosexual community have hundreds or even thousands of partners."
That didn't matter. What mattered is that there was somebody out there in that audience who was listening, who needed to hear it was okay. And that was the only person I was worried about. The rest of those people didn't matter at all to me.
When I think about you, I think about all the things that you've done in your life and the way that you walk your talk. And I really admire that because I don't know very many people in my life like you. And my relationship with you has had one of the most profound effects on who I am as a person. There will never be words for it, but thanks.
I appreciate that. I really do.
John Brown, with his brother Paul in West Virginia.
Our final story comes from Julio Diaz, a social worker in New York City. Every day, he'd end his hour-long subway commute to the Bronx one stop early, just so he could eat at his favorite diner. But one night, as he stepped off the 6 train and onto a nearly empty platform, his evening took an unexpected turn.
So I get off the train, you know, I'm walking towards the stairs, and this young teenager pulls out a knife. He wants my money. So I just gave him my wallet and told him, "Here you go." He starts to leave, and as he's walking away, I'm like, "Hey, wait a minute, you forgot something. If you're going to be robbing people for the rest of the night, you might as well take my coat to keep you warm." So, you know, he's looking at me like, "What's going on here, you know?" And he asked me, "Well, why are you doing this?" And I'm like, "Well, I don't know, man. If you're willing to risk your freedom for a few dollars, then I guess you must really need the money. I mean, all I wanted to do was go get dinner. And if you really want to join me, hey, you're more than welcome." So I'm like, "Look, you can follow me if you want." You know, I just felt maybe he really needs help. So, you know, we go into the diner where I normally eat. We sit down in the booth and the manager comes by, the dishwashers come by, the waiters come by to say hi, you know. So the kid was like, man, but you know everybody here. Do you own this place? I'm like, no, I just eat here a lot. He's like, but you're even nice to the dishwasher. I'm like, well, haven't you been taught you should be nice to everybody? So he's like, yeah, but I didn't think people actually behave that way. So I just asked him in the end, I'm like, you know, what is it that you want out of life? He just had almost a sad face. Either he couldn't answer me or he didn't want to. The bill came and I look at him and I'm like, look, I guess you're going to have to pay for this bill because you have my money and I can't pay for this. So if you give me my wallet back, I'll gladly treat you. He didn't even think about it. He's like, yeah, okay, here you go. So I got my wallet back and I gave him $20 for it. You know, I figure maybe it'll help him. I don't know. And when I gave him the $20, I asked him to give me something in return, which was his knife. And he gave it to me. You know, it's funny because when I told my mom about what happened, you know, no mom wants to hear this. But with her, she was like, well, you know, you're the type of kid that always someone asked you for the time. You gave them your watch. And I figure, you know, you treat people right. You can only hope that they treat you right. It's as simple as it gets in this complicated world.
That's all for this episode, which we started off with me telling a story about my dad.
So is there anyone in your life who's one of these people? Someone who just finds their own way? If there is, tell us about them.
We've set up a voicemail line especially for podcast listeners. The number is 702-706-TALK. We'll occasionally be asking for you to call in about specific things, like who you want to interview, but you can also call in and leave messages for anyone that you hear on this show. We'll pass them on and maybe even feature you in a future episode.
The number again is 702-706-TALK. Or you can email us at podcast@storycorps.org.
Find out how to record your own story on our website. And while you're there, you can support our work. Visit donate.storycorps.org/podcast.
Next week, a father and son remember their unique birds and the bees talk.
So, how did you find out that I was actually a porn star?
So, get ready for that one. Judd Esty Kendall is our senior producer. Max Youngrice is our producer. Our technical director is Jarrett Floyd.
Special thanks to Yasmina Guerda, Emily Martinez, John White, and Katie Simon, as well as StoryCorps facilitators Francesco De Salvatore, Stephanie Burton, Brett Myers, and Michelle Swinehart. I'm Michael Garofalo.
And I'm Jasmine Morris. As always, thanks for listening.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.